Unabashed.
The most unpredictable
becomes a headline.
The most volatile,
outrageous behavior,
unsubstantiated narratives,
a battle of personalities.
So this week on the Grant Thomasha podcast, we're going to do something a little different. Last Friday, I had the chance to sit down with the chief economic advisor to the government of India, Krishnamurthy Subramaniam, at the India Ideas Conference hosted by the Georgetown University India Initiative. His visit to Georgetown was co-sponsored by the Federation of Indian Chambers of Commerce and Industry. Subramaniam was tapped for the job in December 2018 and is making his first visit to Washington, D.C. in his official capacity. He and I talked about the Indian economy and the challenges that lie ahead. We thought Grant Thomasha listeners would be interested in what the new CEA had to say, and so we're bringing you our conversation in its entirety.
Our first panel takes advantage of the visit of the new chief economic advisor of the government of India to Washington, D.C. for the IMF World Bank meetings and other engagements, and I'm very grateful that he has taken the time this morning to come join us over here. I'm going to ask Mr. Sandeep Somani, president of FICCI, to come up in a second to introduce our chief economic advisor. Mr. Somani is a distinguished entrepreneur and business person from India. He's an engineer by trade, but has built an incredibly successful business in housewares and is really a pioneer in the Indian ceramics industry. I've asked Milan Vaishnav, who's director of the South Asia Program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, to moderate this conversation. If you don't know Milan's work already, I'd be surprised. But Milan, of course, is the author of a very important book on Indian elections. He now has a new podcast called Grant Thomasha that I encourage you to check out, especially right now at election season. And I'm sure you can hear more about that a little later this morning as well, when Milan moderates a second panel on the Indian elections itself.
Thank you very much for that introduction. Thank you to Irfan, to the India Initiative at Georgetown, and to the university for making this possible. And welcome to the newly inducted Chief Economic Advisor to the Government of India, Dr. Subramaniam. Congratulations on
Thank
your
you.
New job.
Thank you.
And welcome to Washington.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen.
So let's just go right in, because I know your time is short and we have a busy day ahead of us. We are meeting on the sidelines of the spring meetings of the IMF and the World Bank. The IMF recently put out their annual World Economic Outlook, and the title of their new report sort of summarizes the contents pretty aptly: Growth Slowdown, Precarious Recovery. I would like to just begin the conversation with a macro question about how India is situated right now in the global economic environment. We have a number of disconcerting trends, whether it's questions about Brexit and the Eurozone, questions about the negative implications of the US-China trade war, and other headwinds lingering in the air. Tell us how India is positioned as you see it right now.
First of all, let me thank the organizers for having me here. I'm really happy to be here. Milan, just quickly talk about what has been the performance, you know, and my interpretation of the way in which the Indian economy has done, to try and sort of answer that question. As you would know, I think over the last 5 years, the average growth rate for GDP has been 7.5%. A significant part of that growth has come from domestic consumption, which I think is quite pertinent in the context of what you are talking about, especially because given the sort of the linkage of the Indian economy with the world that had happened, I think the fact that a significant part of the growth has come from domestic consumption, which itself, if you think about it, sort of scratch the surface a little bit, that links to the really benign inflation environment that has been there. The average rate of inflation has been about between 4 and 4.5%. Contrast that with 10% plus double-digit inflation that was prevailing up until 2014. So a lot of purchasing power has been put in the hands of the middle class and the bottom of the pyramid. So we did a counterfactual estimation and said if those 10% plus rates of inflation had prevailed, a lot of essential commodities would have been about 30 to 35% costlier than what they actually are. And that's the purchasing power that I'm talking about, through the domestic class, which then sort of provides resilience, because this purchasing power has been created in the middle class and the bottom of the pyramid, I do reckon that despite some of the, you know, the headwinds that will be coming from global growth, I think we should be able to continue clocking, you know, 7.7, you know, and thereabouts, 7% thereabouts. Of course, we'd, you know, I think if the global economy starts doing better and thereby our exports pick up, then, you know, you would actually expect that those tailwinds to then sort of start really, you know, pushing our growth further. But I think despite the headwinds, I am actually confident that we should be able to clock 7% thereabouts definitely over the next 5 years.
So I want to shift a bit from the macro environment to what's happening within India's borders. You know, one of the most critical domestic economic challenges, and you talked about this, written about this, is the twin balance sheet issue, right? So this combination of non-performing assets on the books of largely public sector banks and infrastructure and other companies which have highly indebted balance sheets. Together, these have acted in combination as a sort of vice on the Indian economy, which have kept investments low. Where do you think things stand today in terms of addressing or unpacking this sort of binding constraint?
So, before I get to that question, let me talk about, because it's quite related, one of the key reforms that has happened over the last 5 years, which is the enactment of the Insolvency and Bankruptcy Code. If those who have been observing India over the last several decades, I think one of the things that generally, you know, has pained, you know, academics like us, is the fact that a lot of the businesses used to play a game, you know, toss a coin, you know, heads you win, tails the bank loses, right? And that used to happen because of the way in which there was basically, so we had capitalism without exit because the bankruptcy code was just not there. And one of the key, you know, sort of, I think, this is something that here, you know, in the US everybody agrees that you can't have capitalism without entry or exit, you know, both functioning, you know, simultaneously well. So the bankruptcy code thereby, I think, is a key piece of reform, because what it has done, and just sort of to talk about some of the economic effects and thereby then link it to your, you know, your question, which is that so over the last last about 24 odd months since the passage of the bankruptcy code, about 3 trillion rupees, which translates into about $42 billion of you know, assets that were stuck because they were non-performing, those have been recovered through the bankruptcy, you know, code because of the IBC. Now, these are large numbers, very large numbers that we're talking about. But more importantly, now this is actually what is an ex post phenomenon, that, you know, once the assets were already bad, you know, things that have been recovered. But as economists, we actually think a lot more about the ex ante effects that it creates. The ex ante effect is the fact that because now a promoter or a shareholder actually worries about the fact that if he or she does not repay, there is the legitimate, you know, fear that the company could be taken to bankruptcy and thereby lose control. So there is a credible threat now that the promoter faces. And thereby what is, you know, it's creating is this behavioral change now. And when we talk to, you know, to sort of banks, we, you know, what we find is that the recovery or the likelihood of the loan getting repaid, that has increased significantly. And this is quite important for us to understand both, you know, the dual balance sheet problem, but also more broadly the gross capital formation in the economy, because, you know, people have been saying, oh, you know, the pickup in the private capital formation, for instance, has not been that good. It's been anemic. And I would like to explain that, remember that, you know, the Indian corporates actually had been doing capital budgeting, and the Indian banks were actually lending money for such capital budgeting projects in a regime where there was very little threat for the shareholder. And therefore, the shareholder, the promoter could actually not be very careful about the capital budgeting, the projections, because he or she knew very well that if things basically came to a pass, things didn't work out very well, you know, he could sit across the bank and, you know, either evergreen the loan or actually, you know, continue it. And in fact, there's one famous promoter who basically has, you know, is publicly quoted as saying that the culture here is, you know, if we basically don't repay, you give us more money. And that's been the, Now, from that scenario to actually now a scenario where you really run the risk of losing control, you know, you have to be very, very careful about a capital budgeting. You cannot just basically pull out numbers out of a hat and put it on an Excel sheet and show it to the bank and say, okay, fund me the project now. And therefore, this behavioral change is something that will take time, you know, for capital budgeting to be done more carefully. At the same time, on the bank side as well, you have, you know, and this, there's a classic phenomenon happens across the world where banks become once, you know, bitten, twice shy. There's risk aversion, especially because a large part of the Indian banking sector is dominated by the public sector banks, governments, where for various reasons, the, you know, the, this is one of the problems that we need to be working on, the equating of bad judgment with malafide intent. And that thereby, you know, really exacerbates the risk aversion because, you know, the whole business of banking, in general business itself, is about taking risk, you know, a priori. And when you take risk, it involves judgment as well. And sometimes things go bad, you know, exposed. You take a, you know, make a judgment call, you know, things don't go very well. But if a bad judgment, you know, later is equated to be malafide intent, then obviously the banker will become risk averse. So on the supply side and the demand side, you have actually, you know, a process that it's this has to go through. There's a, maybe a painful correction, but it has to go through where firms become more careful about the way in which they do the capital budgeting, and banks themselves also get out of this the risk aversion cycle they've gotten into, and are at the same time careful about what kind of projects to fund. So that's what is actually holding back the, you know, the capital, private capital formation. And the, just to, now to finish this particular, you know, your question about the dual balance sheet problem. So the, you know, the trough for the non-performing assets has already been, you know, that was about 2 years back. So clearly there is, you know, the NPA cycle has turned. Mm-hmm. Also, the bank credit, especially to large firms, those numbers have actually started growing now quite robustly. But the animal spirits will take some time for them to come back because the animal spirits, and I hope this time actually, and you know, we sort of let this process continue so that the animal spirits do not come with irrational exuberance, but they come with actually where the projects are well evaluated and money is put in the right, in those projects which are really positive NPV. That is a process that will basically, you know, happen because of the bankruptcy code and the behavioral change that it is creating. Let's, you know, we have to be patient because behavioral change does not happen overnight. It takes time.
Supplement with an additional piece of information. So the RBI did a study recently and the average capacity utilization across industry has now reached 78%. Now at 78%, as many of you may know, in India to even start a brownfield expansion can take anywhere between 12 to 18 months for it to come on stream. So I think in the latter part of this year and certainly next year, you will see an uptake in capital investment because otherwise companies will start losing customers. And as far as what Dr. Subramaniam said, I think from a business point of view, I think the single most important legislation the government has done in the last 5 years is, of course, the introduction of GST, which is a unified VAT system and replaced 28 different laws of taxation. But I think the second most important thing is this insolvency and bankruptcy code. And I can tell you, from an entrepreneur point of view, the old concept of the Wild Wild West has gone, finished. The government has realized close to $30 billion without even taking those companies to, the banks have realized nearly $30 billion without even taking the company to bankruptcy. Just the threat of bankruptcy has released close to $30 billion. So I think the threat of losing their companies is great. And it's a good thing for the economy. It's a great thing because it separates the good promoters and entrepreneurs from the ones who were a bit dubious, but were giving the whole community a bad name.
And let me add, I think this is something where, you know, not enough credit has been given to India. You know, if you look at over the last few months, you know, you've had a set of brothers who actually, you know, and you know the brothers, the three sets of brothers that I'm talking about, who actually have been told by the court to repay or go to jail. Now, you know, for me as an Indian, this is unheard of. And I think about if, you know, the way I think about crony capitalism or cronyism in an economy, think about a 2x2 matrix, and you know, you have ex ante or sort of think about, let's say, de jure law versus de facto, and you actually have on the other axis the large or well connected versus the average person. And the difference between de jure versus de facto, the way the law operates, and the way that does for the well-connected person who can actually work the system versus, let's say, the average person, that is a measure of the cronies in the economy. Now, here in the case of the bankruptcy code, you've had the dirty dozen, right? You know, the top 12 defaulters actually being taken to bankruptcy together with the other borrowers. And you have people who, you know, it's unheard of, actually, these people to be able to say, you know, being even told that you might have to go to jail. And I think I, as a common citizen of this country, I'm so glad to be seeing this, that for the first time, actually, at least in parts, and I mean, you know, that is not to say that we still have to go a distance, but at least a start has been made where we basically don't, you know, have this dictum where you know, you show me the law and then show me the person on whom I have to apply the law, and then I'll tell you how it has to be applied. I think it's a welcome departure from that aspect, which, you know, especially I think the way the media covers some of this, I think not enough has been talked about, you know, about what has happened in India over the last five years.
It reminds me of that great dictum from a former Latin American dictator who said, you know, for my friends, everything, for my enemies, the law. Right.
And I think, you know, you know what I'm talking about. Yeah. These three sets of without naming them.
Let me just because I want to save room for questions, but there are a few more issues I just want to dig into very quickly. And Mr. Somani has given me a nice segue with GST. So this is one of the big reforms which has been talked about almost 20 years now, which this government has brought across the finish line. Yet in India, there's a lot of chatter about how to streamline GST, both to improve compliance, as well as how do you reduce the onerous burdens which are placed, particularly on small and medium enterprises. What do you see, irrespective of what happens in the next 6 weeks with the elections, what do you think is the roadmap for how we get to a GST that addresses both of these sets of issues?
Okay. So, before I come to that, let me preamble by, you know, so my research has been, for instance, in law and economics and finance, right? I've looked at law changes across the world in many, many, cases across different laws. And what we, again, I think sometimes we actually, impatience is good, but I think some amount of realism is important as well. When you look at seminal law changes anywhere in the world, those take time for them to actually sort of, you know, calibrate into perfection or calibrate into the optimal. It doesn't happen. You don't basically, you know, enact a law and it basically hits perfection right away. There is, especially in a country like India, as diverse, as many stakeholders, as many constituents as there are. So GST, you know, and so, for instance, sometimes there is this point made about, you know, we have too many rates. Yeah. I actually look at it saying, at least we've got the camel under the tent. You know, if we basically said, let's insist on just one rate, you know, it wouldn't have happened. The other important aspect to take into account, I think this is, as an economist, I look at this historically, India has reformed only when faced with a crisis. But for the first time here, it actually, you know, we've had some, you know, important reform that has happened despite there being no crisis. And critically, as you know, this, there are two key drivers that have happened. As economists, we talk about what are called side bets, you know, the ability to make side bets, right? In the case of the GST, the center, which actually has deep pockets as a sovereign, can write checks, right? You know, came together with the state. And, you know, for instance, if you go back to what, you know, the economists think about the Coase-Kosian bargaining, right? We assume that all frictions, there are no frictions. But in the real world, there are lots of frictions in bargaining. And here you have a situation where the center said, start with the states and said, okay, here are some states which are producer states who actually are potential losers. And these are the ones that are going to hold out in actually being arriving at a solution that is actually optimal for the country. So the center said, okay, let me make a side bet with you, actually, and commit to you. Let's anticipate what your losses will be in the next 5 years, okay? And importantly there, now, when you're anticipating, you know, the expected versus the realized, there can be risk there. And, you know, path-breaking reform never happens in a risk vacuum. It actually requires the political, you know, establishment to be able to take risk. The reason this did not happen, you know, why feet was dragged for 10 years was because the risk appetite was not there. So in this case, there was that risk-taking ability and said, okay, let's project what is the loss, and let me make that side bet. The center said, let's make that side bet and let's get people, you know, that's how you bargain, you know, I mean, basically in a multi-party bargaining for, you know, and that template that you have, I think, can be applied in lots of other situations wherever you have center and state, especially. So basically you identify the potential losers, make the side bets, do some projections for what are the losses going to be, and take some risk to be able to. These are critical for reform, which can be then implemented. You know, now to get back to the sort of the nitty gritties of GST, I think that we certainly do need a couple of important changes. You know, the whole premise of the GST is that you use invoice level matching. And you use invoice level matching for two purposes. Number one, what you do is you actually accumulate all the invoices. So suppose I am the buyer, you are the seller. You know, I actually have all the invoices, you know, that you've sold to me, and maybe, you know, and it's been sold by others as well. What I do is I match all of that to basically verify whether the costs that I'm claiming are those actually correct or not, number one. But number two, what is actually, and you know, those of you sort of think about actually just doing a simple matrix inversion, because the amount of stuff that I've bought is just a linear combination of everything that people have sold. And so you invert that matrix, you should be able to get the actual amount that people have sold, right, by using this invoice level matching. And that's why it's a critical part of the GST itself, which is the invoice level matching. For various reasons, you know, that's something that has not happened, but should happen, I think. And that's something that should be the next step, because then, when, you know, and what has happened, for instance, the GST numbers have been coming down, because once people start knowing that the invoice level matching is not happening, I can actually go and claim any amount of costs, and I can basically, you know, sort of declare revenues as well, and the checks are not happening. So the invoice level matching, I think, is an important part of the next step to GST, which then should make really help in, you know, in pushing up indirect taxes actually to the levels that were anticipated.
So I want to ask a question that stems from work that your predecessor, another Dr. Subramaniam, and no relation as far as I know, Arvind Subramaniam, made a strong pitch a few years ago in the flagship report that the CEA puts out every year, the Economic Survey of India, for a universal basic income, or really a quasi, what he called a quasi-universal basic income-like instrument. Since then, we have seen several states, namely Telangana and Odisha, implement new unconditional cash transfer schemes, partially to deal with this issue of agrarian distress in the rural sector. The central government has recently done this for small farmers through the PM Kisan scheme, where small farmers get a guaranteed annual payment of 6,000 rupees sent to their bank accounts. This is something that was just unveiled a few months ago. The question for you is, are these UBI or quasi-UBI-like schemes here to stay? And if they are, how concerned are you about the fiscal implications? Because some of the cost projections are quite large. And in a situation where already India struggles to meet the current deficit targets, how concerned should we be about how these two things come together?
So I have a couple of, you know, important points to make here. Number one, I think the first word in UBI is universal. Therefore, you know, whatever you're getting now does not have universality in it. So, you know, I these are basically apples and oranges, in my opinion.
Because they end up being targeted towards one segment of the population,
to universal basic income. Because second, I think this is, theory of political economy tells us that in a democracy, the preferences of the median person, right, if you rank people starting from, you know, top to bottom in terms of income, that median person's preferences have to be reflected in policy, mm-hmm. because democracy is basically by the people for the people. And it can't be by the people for basically the top 10% or maybe, you know, it has to be the median person's preferences have to matter. And that is, I think, important to keep in mind also with another aspect, which is, you know, think about public goods provision, right? In India, you know, I think, and this is true in many other, you know, emerging economies as well, people like you and me, you know, we can actually substitute the public goods in the private market. For instance, if, let's say, you know, I don't get good education from the government schools, I send my kids to private school. If I don't get good healthcare from the, you know, from the government hospitals, I go to the private hospitals. If I don't get good security from the police, I actually have private guards. Right. If I don't get electricity, you know, I actually get, you know, put generators, right? People like you and me can, you know, substitute every public good that the government should be providing in the private market. But this median, you know, person that we're talking about cannot actually do that, number one. Number two, you know, this median person also suffers from the fact that because coverage of insurance actually is not that large, even temporary shocks actually have permanent debilitating effects. So the absence of public goods, or let's say the you know, lack of adequate provision of public goods, which, you know, last 70 years, I think something that we've not done well enough, combined with the absence of insurance actually makes them, you know, quite vulnerable. So I think this is the backdrop against which we have to be evaluating some of the, you know, some of the policies that are being made. Now, specifically, let me come to the PM Kisan scheme. If you look at what is called the risk-adjusted return, right? You know, the risk-return payoff that a farmer faces, the returns are not that high, but the risk, whether it's actually on the production side or even on the marketing side, the risks are huge, right? Climate risks, you know, even after yield risk, you know, a bunch of things. Even after he's produced, whether actually he'll be able to fetch a good price for his produce or not, these are all the risks that he faces. So, you know, as financial economists, we think about what is called alpha. The alpha is actually hugely negative in farming, right? Now, combined with that, what you also have is a food economy where the food production is growing at more than 3%, while the population is growing at less than 1%. So you inevitably will have surpluses. Right. And surpluses, you know, Econ 101 tells you that therefore you'll have dampened prices. You know, what people are talking about basically that, you know, lack of or deflation in food of, you know, inflation, which is basically the simple, you know, artifact of this feature. Therefore, there has to be, you know, given what I talked about the median, you know, person's preferences, you have to actually take care of that. And what PM Kisan does, while people have talked about on the, you know, on the return side, I think as economists, we should be focusing on the risk aspect as well. What this critically does, and, you know, is that because 2,000 rupees is given every 4 months, it's assured income. And that assured income brings down the risk significantly. So we did some sort of, you know, back of the envelope kind of calculations, assuming some distribution, let's say, you know, no one knows what is the true distribution of cash flows, let's say, for a farmer. But if you make some distributional assumptions and take into account the fact that the prices of potatoes, for instance, is about 30 times as volatile, you know, if you take the standard deviation as the mean, that means it's hugely volatile, right? So this assured return every 4 months of 2,000 rupees really reduces the risk significantly. And if I say it differently, you know, with a 1/3 probability, a person actually who's growing cereals, you know, rice or wheat, can actually be earning less than 2,000 rupees with a one in three chance. And in that, you know, that state of the world, when actually that 1 in 3 probability indeed manifests, then this 2,000 rupees actually, you know, really acts as huge sucker for that person. So that's the way I would look at it as an economist. I think the fiscal part is something that what you're bringing up is important. The way I would look at it is that, you know, given some of the steps that we're taking on the revenue side, we should be trying to create the space for taking, you know, care of some of the vulnerabilities of, you know, of people who actually sort of need some of the attention.
So I'm cognizant of the time. I wanted to let's see here. Okay, we have a few more minutes. So great. So Mr. Somani, I wanted to bring you into this conversation. One issue which gets a lot of airtime in Washington, D.C., and I imagine in other world capitals as well, is the need for factor market reform in India, this, particularly issues of land and labor, right? If you look at any business manifesto anywhere, these are always prominently featured. The question for you is, how important do you actually think these reforms are in terms of getting the animal spirits of the economy going? And are there things happening perhaps at the subnational level? We know these things are very difficult to do at the national level because of India's political economy. Are there things happening at, say, the state level that we should be paying attention to when it comes to easing the constraints on businesses acquiring land, hiring and firing workers, scaling up, so on?
Okay, so that's a very good question, actually. So as you know, India has significantly improved its positioning in terms of the ease of doing business. But what business is concerned about is the cost of doing business has not gone down. And if you look at it, there are three components to that. Land, labor, and I think a very immediate component in terms of interest rates. I think interest rates in India are at a historical high. The repo rates... Fortunately, we have a new RBI governor who is very open to at least meeting the various constituents, getting inputs from them. So as FICCI, we've gone and met the RBI governor. He was very receptive to our thoughts. And he is walking the path. He has twice in the last 3 months reduced interest rates by 0.25% each. If you ask me whether that's enough, certainly not. That doesn't bring out any animal spirits. And also there's a transmission problem. When the reductions are small, we've noticed that the banks absorb it to offset their other issues. So the industry doesn't get the full benefit, and definitely not the small guy. But we are hopeful that he sees the bigger picture and he knows that that is a hindrance to new investment. But I think that's not the only hindrance. I think the issues of land and labor, let me deal with it separately. In industry, I'm very clear, the last government passed this act where they quadrupled the price of acquisition of land. I think that was a wrong act. It is an act which is negative and will act against industrialization of the country. The current government tried to find some loopholes and maneuver around it, but unfortunately they did not have the majority in the upper house of parliament, so it did not work out. However, having said that, I think if they come back with good numbers, they may make an attempt again in the future. In the meanwhile, the state governments have enough land which they have acquired previously. So if you ask me if industrialization has suffered in these last 5 years, it hasn't. And maybe they have enough land for another 4 to 5 years. So I think to that extent we are okay. But once the existing land bank runs out and they do not change the Land Act, I think we are in for trouble, because the cost of acquisition of land the cost will go through the roof. And the second, it becomes extremely torturous to acquire large pieces of land in the first place. So that is a real concern. I think on labor, I think it's over-harped. Particularly foreigners don't understand the possibilities of manipulating the system so that, and all legally, that you can manage. See, the days of strikes and all are over now. We don't lose much mandates. India is poor in terms of labor productivity. So all the Indian politicians will tell you Indian labor is cheap. Yes, it's cheap, but it's very unproductive. So net-net, if you offset the productivity and the cost, I don't think they're that cheap, frankly. And large companies are now investing in artificial intelligence, robots, mechanization. So it's not the large companies which will drive the employment up. But there are a lot of mid-sized companies which still hire, small companies still hire. I think this government has done something which has not got any publicity at all, which is very important. So the government has said that we allow, this was originally done by the current government to encourage employment in certain sectors which are labor intensive, like textiles, footwear, leather, that kind of stuff. But they have now extended to across all industries. And what they've said is that you can employ labor on a contractual basis. That means if you now need to employ somebody for 2 years, you give a 2-year contract. After 2 years, that labor is no more with you. Now, as you know, as you many of you may know, labor is a contract, is a concurrent subject. That means the center has responsibility for labor and each of the states can make their own laws. Many states which are progressive have already made their own laws and have passed this legislation. So you can appoint somebody for 6 months, you can appoint somebody for 1 year, 2 years, 3 years, it's your discretion. And therefore you can circumvent our very tight labor laws by bringing in this component.
So we have just a few minutes for questions, and I'm sure we have many of them. So I'll just ask you to please, I think, are there mics going around, Irfan? Is there a microphone? Yeah. So wait for the mic. Please identify yourself and make your question a true question, and please make them short. I will have to cut you off if you've gone for too long. Let's start right here with this young woman here in the second row.
Good morning. My name is Kajal Joshi. I'm a student at the George Washington University. My question is, we've been talking about labor issues. We've been talking about, especially in the agricultural sector, the importance of the PM Kisan scheme. What about the landless? Why aren't we seeing more schemes like Kalia and Odisha, you know, being driven by the center to take care of nearly the 50% of agricultural labor, which is landless?
That's great. If you don't mind, should we take one or two
Sure.
questions? And then that way we can, this gentleman here in the first row.
Sir, very good point you brought
Could
up.
Could you just please identify yourself?
Yeah. This is Udaya Alu. I am working for Department of Labor in U.S. federal government. I am going through so many economic conferences. So, I am nice to meet you. The question is, have a general comparison between Indian economy and Chinese economy, especially in terms of productivity. To be concrete example, I am not able to see the Dollar Tree material by Indian labor here, but I see many Chinese products by Dollar Tree kind of issues. Why Indian economy is not able to do that? And how other aspects of Indian economy is totally different, or communist capitalism or democratic capitalism, whatever you say, is different from Chinese labor. As he's saying, Indian labor is less productive. Can you make a clear impact of why we are not able to make the Indian labor more productive?
Okay, great. So great. Why don't we take those quickly, and if we have time, we'll do another round. The question on what should we be doing, why shouldn't we be doing more on landless, and this question about what are differences on productivity between India and China. Would you like to go first?
I think that, you know, the point you're making is a very valid one. Unfortunately, data on the landless is actually, you know, is very, very scarce, and, you know, it's sparse. And if you have to, and as a government, if you want to be intervening or, you know, doing a program, you have to have data. Otherwise, what will happen is you'll have inclusion and exclusion errors. And for instance, the PM Kisan scheme, you know, could have possibly, if one had data, let's say, on the tenant farmers as well, they are clearly a lot more vulnerable than even those small and marginal farmers, less than 2.5 hectares. But when you don't have that data, you know, it's very hard to sort of, you know, either design or, you know, target the program on them. So that's sort of in my opinion, the short answer to, I think, you know, your question is, of course, is maybe should be the topic of one full debate. there are lots of, you know, differences. I would think, you know, and I quite agree that the labor productivity is actually is low, which also goes back to skilling. I think, you know, overall our emphasis, somehow our skilling programs have actually not done as well, partly because, you know, skilling, especially for adults, you know, and should be demand driven, should be, you know, market driven. Of course, I don't think I have a special fascination for any country. Anything that works anywhere, actually, we should be learning from them. If you look at, you know, countries like both China and Germany, right? Germany has a very good program for, you know, for basically the way people work, you know, as apprentices, etc. So there are aspects that we can learn from there. Our skilling programs have so far been too much of push-driven and have not been calibrated well for what the you know, the market really demands. So the productivity issue, in my opinion, is both a skilling and an education issue as well.
Do you want to weigh on this question?
No, I would just say that from the industry point of view, skilling is very important, and our schools don't give the real skills required by the people in terms of the education curriculum. So that, I think, that someday the government has to change the system to be able to skill them better while they are still in school. Secondly, we believe, and we have proposed to the government, that give a small flexibility to industry, let them fire or hire. We don't like the word hire and fire. The politicians don't accept it. But let them be given flexibility to remove 5% of the labor force. That's it. We believe the productivity will go up significantly because there will be some fear. Today, there's no fear. So under fear, the workers work better.
Exactly as it's happening in the IBC.
Exactly.
let's take a question from this gentleman here.
My name also is Dr. Subramanian.
Oh, my goodness.
But it is Siva Subramanian, no relationship. But I am a good friend of Arvind Subramanian, with proper disclosure. I'm just focusing on two aspects of it, and one else you already addressed in terms of the landless and the question of the GDP, 7%, even though it is, I mean, compared to here, it is significant. Is that something that is sufficient for over a period of time to be able to get the economy going to where it should be? And then the second is, are there any other programs that you're looking at, the medium income that you talked about, the middle income being the largest, in terms of it, what are that is being planned?
Okay, that's great. Right here on the aisle, please.
Hi, Dr. Subramaniam. I'm Siddhi Doshi from Brookings Institution, and thanks for being here. My question is that economic statistics in India seem to be in somewhat of a crisis, and as a macroeconomics researcher, these inconsistencies really make me nervous and uncomfortable, and I was wondering if you had any solutions, insights on the same.
Great, thank you. So one question on, is 7.5% or 7% good enough? Mm-hmm. And question on the sanctity or reliability of data.
So first of all, let me, talk about this. We're doing some work on this, so I'm speaking based on, hopefully we'll have a more crystallized, but I'm going to give you a work in process answer here. Firstly, let me, having been there for 3 months, and having observed from close quarters, India is a democracy where the number of touch points for policy are so many that it is very hard to create a narrative that is different from the truth. Somebody will squeal, it's very, very hard. For instance, those numbers come to me, I definitely believe I care for my reputation a lot more than being in a particular office for a few years. So like that, there are so many different. So it's, first on the process, it's very hard to create a narrative. The media can create a narrative, but inside the government, to create a narrative that is different from the truth, it's very hard. Now let me come to your, there are two aspects, what has happened is actually earlier our GDP series was based on the factor cost, Now we are doing based on GVA. And if you look at the changes that have happened, we're using better proxies. For instance, instead of using the IIP numbers, we use the MCA, right?
Could you just explain financial quickly?
Yeah, let me actually. IIP is the Index of Industrial Production, and MCA is the Ministry of Corporate Affairs, the financial statements. So all companies in India, whether they're listed or unlisted, have to actually file their license to basically be a company is given by the registrar of companies, and they have to go and file their financial statements with the Ministry of Corporate Affairs. And this is a fact that any company that actually has a financial statement has to be audited by an auditor first, has to be passed by the board of directors. The board has to sign on it, with especially the audit committee chairman signing on it. And then it has to be put to the to the MCA, which goes over it as well. So you have three levels of checks. So the Index of Industrial Production actually does not have any of those checks. This has been replaced. So the MCA is what is being used for calculating manufacturing, you know, the value added there instead of the IIP numbers. To give you one example of the kind of proxies that are being used, because, you know, just to sort of give you a more concrete, you know, example, take the value added in telecom. Earlier, the proxy that was being used was the number of subscribers. Now, suppose, you know, I have a phone, you have a phone as well, okay? I don't use my phone very much. You use your phone very, very intensively. Clearly, you're creating a lot more economic activity than I am doing. But if you're using the number of subscribers, you and I are basically painted with the same brush. But the new series, for instance, uses the number of minutes of usage as the proxy for calculating the gross value added in the telecom sector. This is one example of actually a better proxy being used, right? Overall, if you see, and we're basically, you know, I cannot tell you emphatically, we're doing some numbers here. If you look at the first estimate versus the final estimate that comes, and in manufacturing, there is what is called the Annual Survey of Industries, the ASI, which actually is, that series goes back very long, from 1981. There's no change in that at all. And if you look at the value added that has happened, if you look at the growth in value added, that relates very well with the growth that has happened in the GDP as well. And if we look at the changes, so for instance, the IIP numbers used to come up, and then the revisions would come up many times 2 years later through the ASI. Now, you know, that because it came so late, people wouldn't pay that much attention. Now what happens is you basically, the MCA numbers come up much sooner, and you can go and check the ASI. If you look at the differences between the first estimate and the final estimate from the ASI using the IIP numbers and using the current MCA versus the ASI, you actually find the errors are lower. And, you know, now there's actually this concept of first-order stochastic dominance and second-order stochastic dominance in statistics. We're working on that to see whether actually that indeed these hold, the statistical tests hold. I can't tell you that, but the errors actually are lower, which is reflecting the fact that the proxies are better, okay? Number two, that on the demonetization year, for instance, if you actually, people talk about the you know, the increases. Let's also remember that the same series is also telling us that the previous two quarters, growth has slowed down. So, you know, if it were actually a narrative that was developing, right, you could develop a narrative, you know, we would do, why not? Even this one, let's say you're having really, really good growth. Why reveal that, you know, the second two quarters actually are not doing very well, right? Which goes back to my point of actually it's very hard in India to build a narrative different from the truth. The demonetization here, if you look at it, you take GDP growth as GVA, you know, gross value added plus taxes, the biggest increase has been in taxes. And that we know very well, that demonetization increased taxes. So the change in the, you know, in the GDP growth rates for the demonetization year, there's not been that much change in GVA, it's been changes in the taxes. So bottom line, that, you know, I actually can tell you that, you know, all this talk about this numbers being, you know, either people basically do not understand the nitty-gritty, or there's something else to this narrative. And the last point on this jobs, you know, which people are also the, people talk about the periodic labor force survey versus the employment and unemployment survey. Now, there is this narrative that has developed which saying that, oh, the unemployment rate is at its historical highest. That again is actually either misinformation or actually something else, because the sampling methodology in the periodic labor force survey is very different from the, you know, from the employment unemployment survey. The employment unemployment survey, which is based on actual consumption or the wealth of the person. In contrast, the PLFS, the periodic labor force survey, the sampling is based on the level of education, because the reason this survey was created was to be able to measure formal sector jobs. So the way the sampling is done is you look at households who have at least one person who has cleared the 10th standard, okay? So zero persons, you know, who've cleared 10th standard, 1, 2, etc. And this, the PLFS puts 75% weight on those households that have at least one member who has passed 10th grade. Now, in the population, if you go and look at the census data, About 65% of households do not have even a single member that has actually cleared the 10th grade. Okay, so what you're doing is, and this is also a fact, it's actually known very well in labor economics, that if you're not educated at all, you will go and work as a daily wage laborer. You will, you know, will be happy to work, get do any work that you get. But if you've studied 10th standard, you would want a little bit better job. And therefore, unemployment rates are always higher among people who actually have 10th plus, you know, 10th or, you know, or better versus others. What is happening in the PLFS, 25% weight is actually being put on those that have 10th grade plus, and 75% weight, sorry, the other way, 75% weight on the people who have, you know, 10th plus, and 25% weight on the other part. Now, you just do a simple weighted average. You have a much higher, you know, unemployment rate here because people are waiting to get jobs. You put 75% weight here and 25% weight there. Obviously, you'll get a higher number. But that is not reflecting the fundamentals. Nothing has changed in the economy. It is actually just a statistical methodology, the sampling methodology that is being reflected. And that is why I say actually either those who are saying that an unemployment rate has been at the historical highest are either misinformed or motivated.
So very quickly, because we're out of time, if you just want to, 60 seconds, if you just want to quickly address this issue, are you satisfied with 7.5%?
You know, I think we should not be satisfied with 7.5. If we want to be a, you know, $10 trillion economy by 2032, which is a vision that we've laid out, we should be growing at 9.5%, 9.5% close to 10%. So, we would have to get there, but we'll get there only if some of the, you know, the productivity that, you know, that was spoken about, the, you know, many of the other frictions that there are, we'll have to remove all, you know, many of those. I think 7.5 is good, clearly, you know, better than what the rest of the world is doing. But I think we have to be, you know, so that we don't miss this round, actually, we have to be growing at close to 9.5%. Where some of the structural reforms that have been done, I think, are important. They should be let to run their course. And, you know, I think it's important that the vested interests are basically kept, you know, at bay, you know, in these aspects. And we sort of, you know, put our head down and remove some of the frictions that are there in the economy. Otherwise, 9.5 is, you know, looks very good on paper. It's not that easy to achieve it either.
So we're over time, and we're, I think the next speaker is ready. So let me thank you, Dr. Subramanian, and you, Mr. Somani, and hope all of you can join me in thanking our guests.
Thank you.
Grant Thamasha is a co-production of the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace and the Hindustan Times. You can find us on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Don't forget to rate and review. It helps others find the show more easily. For more information about the show and to find the writing we reference on this week's episode, visit our website, grantthamasha.com. Production assistance comes from Jamie Hinson and Rachel Osnos. Tim Martin's our audio engineer, and Lauren Duex, our executive producer. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week.